A whole gang of media snoopers, including Jonathan Marks, scans from D.C. to daylight every Thursday here on Radio Netherlands. Their super-duper whopper-doppler-receiver gizmos pick out the essence of what's happening in the world of international broadcasting. Radio Netherlands, we have the technology.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online. Just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
By shortwave, medium wave, satellite, and the internet, this is the Dutch International Service, Radio Netherlands. Media Network. A regular survey of communications developments produced and presented by Diana Jansen and Jonathan Marks.
Hello, it's been a week of shifting emphasis in the world of international broadcasting. More details are coming up, as well as an important follow-up to the Clockwork Wireless project.
So we start with news in brief. Radio Flandre Internationale in Brussels, Belgium, has decided to alter the emphasis of its broadcasts in the direction of the Dutch language as of November next year. They announced this week that some foreign language productions will be axed. Director Monique Delvaux says three are affected.
That means that we won't be transmitting anymore in Spanish, Arabic and German.
The only foreign languages left will be English and French.
Overall, decrease of budget by 10% was announced. So we were in the fire line as the first station of BRTN, and a substantial reduction of our transmissions by shortwave.
RVI will leave English on short and medium wave for listeners in Europe, but plans to drop direct shortwave broadcasts in English to North America and other parts of the world. Programmes will go out in that direction via the World Radio Network, and it's already available in real audio format via the internet.
On the other side, we still keep French on a shortwave transmitter towards Africa, North Africa and Central Africa, because of French-speaking Belgians living over there. I mean, the situation there is still very confused, and that won't stop in the near future.
But in the meantime, RVI is looking for ways to use transmitter facilities outside Belgium. A recent test from Jülich in Germany has proved successful.
We are going to use probably Jülich for Europe and the Middle East.
And RVI is in negotiation with other European broadcasters with a view to exchanging airtime to reach further outside the continent. To Asia now, and analysts are looking at Indonesia at the moment. A bill passed through the parliament this week means that private stations will now be allowed to air their own news programmes instead of having to relay Radio Republik Indonesia. However, government officials will be given the right to censor the programmes and send violators to jail for up to 10 years. So apparently there's still a tight control as to what's said.
Meanwhile, last Monday, the ABC board in Australia announced a package of cuts which will save the corporation $27 million Australian dollars. A radical plan to break down all barriers between the ABC's radio and television division will result in a saving of around 60 senior management positions and 560 staff. The plan is the ABC's board's response to the Australian government's cuts of $55 million, which is to be implemented during the next financial year. The Australian Minister for Communications, Senator Richard Alston, has already stated that he liked the sound of these changes and wants to talk to the ABC about them. On ABC Radio, the chair of the ABC, Mr. Donald MacDonald, outlined what he will tell the minister.
I'll be telling him that these changes are designed to make a better ABC. They are only in part a response to the funding cuts. The move towards one ABC, as this has been characterised by our Managing Director Brian Johns, is in fact a move to make the ABC work better for its audiences, to be closer to its audiences, to give more influence to audiences, particularly those outside of main metropolitan areas, to give greater influence to content providers.
Time will tell whether the ABC's response will be enough for the Australian government.
And last week it was also announced that the Australian government's inquiry into the ABC, chaired by Bob Mansfield, will be published in late January. So the ABC board has deferred until February any decisions on the future of Australia Television and Radio Australia.
On Friday of last week came news that Radio Canada International may close at the end of March. This time last year, we broadcast exactly the same story, but in that case, they were given a 12-month reprieve. We asked Program Director Alan Familiant in Montreal whether it's the same story all over again.
The situation is a little different from last year in that last year we had premonitions and warnings months in advance that we would be in trouble. And then ultimately RCI was faced with closure, and at the last minute our Minister of Heritage, to which the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, to which we belong, reports to, came through with one-year funding with a promise to study long-term funding in the future. This year, everything we had heard up to about the middle of last week were good news, that funding had been found and that there wouldn't be any problem. So it was much more of a shock this year when on Friday the president of the CBC and our executive director announced that government funding was not forthcoming, and the CBC had announced many years ago and consistently throughout that with the budget cuts they faced domestically, they couldn't fund it. So therefore, they announced last Friday that RCI would be closing as of March 31st. So that was really a shock.
Staff at RCI were gathered into a room and fired by CBC officials in Ottawa over a speakerphone. But they haven't given up hope.
I and the rest of RCI didn't, I don't want to say we're insubordinate, but somehow no one seemed to believe the fact that we were going to close on March 31st. No one believed that Canada would make a decision like that.
Did the news last Friday lead to any political pressure?
Well, I think it resulted in some political pressure because between Friday of last week and Tuesday afternoon, Montreal time, the Minister of Heritage, Sheila Copps, was faced with a barrage of questions in the House of Commons, and she came out with a statement saying that the door is not totally closed for RCI and she's still seeking funds.
Which may be found over the next couple of days.
Here at home, it's been tough sailing for Dutch commercial radio and television stations. Earlier this year, Veronica News Radio disappeared from the Dutch airwaves. And last Sunday night, just before midnight, the TV channel Sport 7 pulled the plug, hardly 4 months after its launch on August 18th.
Danken de kijkers die ondanks vele kritiek van de afgelopen maanden toch zijn blijven kijken.
110 people have lost their jobs because of the closure, and the venture turned out to be a financial disaster for its shareholders. The privatized Dutch PTT, now called KPN, the banking company ING, Philips, some cable companies, newspaper De Telegraaf, TV production house Endemol, and the Dutch Football Association, the KNVB, face losses that are estimated as high as 280 million guilders, and that's roughly $175 million.
Cor Boonstra, the new man in charge of Philips, refused to invest further in the Sportzever adventure, especially now that Philips is facing another round of severe cutbacks. It's perhaps significant that Boonstra's predecessor, Jan Timmer, masterminded the first major restructuring scheme called Centurion, and following his retirement, went on to become president of Sportzever. Yet all the major projects on which Philips based its brand new direction in 1990 are quietly being dropped by Cor Boonstra. Digital compact cassette production has stopped, high-definition television has been shelved, and the production of liquid crystal displays discontinued. And the future of Compact Disc Interactive is seriously in doubt now that high-density storage media and faster computers are making the software look terribly slow by comparison. Sportzever is just one of the many projects which Philips is phasing out, though it's not clear from the outside which path the new slimline Philips will follow in 1997. Things have to get better. In the meantime, lawyers are making big money sorting out who actually owns the broadcast rights to Dutch football competitions.
Good news for them. Now a bit of good news from us.
Discover a new world of listening opening shortly here on Radio Netherlands. In 1997, we're celebrating 70 years of international broadcasting from Holland and 50 years of this station. Join us as Diana and Jonathan entice you through the media jungle to discover what's hot and what's a potential disaster. Listen to the latest receiver reviews and call up the results on the World Wide Web. Why not travel with us to Malaysia, Fiji, Chile, and Brazil as we explore the shift from analog to digital, interact, and win valuable anniversary prizes destined to become part of broadcasting's Hall of Fame. And in case you're planning some travel next year, why not join us in Hilversum for the festive open day on June the 7th? Radio Netherlands, all shades of opinion.
Last week on the program, we let you hear the voice on an answering machine, which announced that a company called Stuxen Funds would shortly be broadcasting to Africa and the Middle East from facilities near Johannesburg in South Africa. We traced the president of Stuxen Funds, Jerry Hoffman, to an address in Atlanta, Georgia, USA, and asked him whether the company is already in the broadcasting business.
Not yet, but within the next 2 weeks. We are going to broadcast to some 41 countries in Africa on the investment channel about stocks and funds and investments. It is the best stocks of the day, the best bonds of the day, the best mutual funds of the day, about a man and his money and how it stacks up in the world.
Which begs the question how stocks and funds makes its money.
Stocks and funds, in many cases, places the order. The people respond to stocks and funds. Even though we own the network, we also are investment banker, broker dealers.
Such investment advice services are widespread in North America and Asia. But why did Hoffman select Africa to start such a venture?
People in Africa invest money, don't they? We feel there's a million people out there in Africa who make investments, about a million people.
Programs are being produced in Atlanta using material from the New York Times, Financial Times and Reuters and fed by satellite for broadcast from the transmitters in South Africa.
All the contracts are signed and we hope to start up no later than the first of the year.
Stuxen Funds announces an address in Atlanta which reads 1733 Clifton Road Northeast, Atlanta, Georgia 30329 in the USA.
Our fax number is 404-315-9523. 404 for Atlanta, Georgia, 315-9523.
But won't all the financial information now on the Internet threaten the long-term future of stocks and funds?
No, we are on the Internet as well. Of course, the Internet supplies a different type of material, but we are certainly involved in the Internet.
Dennis Thompson is a British technical consultant and frequency manager who's been asked to set up the schedule for stocks and funds. We asked him how far he's got.
Well, we've pretty much finalised now the frequency choices for the 250 kilowatt schedule, but there's still a little choosing of frequencies to do for the 100 kilowatt service into Southern Africa.
By broadcasting for 18 hours a day, they hope to reach the entire continent of Africa and the Middle East three times, in the morning, lunchtime and in the evening.
And in actual frequency terms, if I start off with the breakfast time, between 02 and 0300 UTC, for the Middle East, there's 6195 kHz and 7175 kHz. Then going on into East Africa between 03 and 04, 9775 kHz and 11985 kHz. Then a little later, continuing into East and then Central and West Africa between 04 and 0800 UTC, 11985 kHz again and 15225 kHz. Then switching to the sort of local lunchtime listening between 08 and 1400 UTC for firstly the Middle East and then later switching beams to Western Central Africa, it's 17735 kHz and 21745 kHz. Then those two frequencies again between 14 and 1600 to the Middle East and East Africa, beginning their sort of evening time listening. 16 to 1700, we switch down to just the single frequency, 17735 kilohertz. And then the last block to Central and West Africa from 1800 to 2200 GMT, that's 15420 kilohertz and 17890 kilohertz.
Tests on that list could start as soon as next week. Once the satellite feed is in place, the program is in 25-minute blocks, starting at the top and bottom of each hour.
We're hoping to lead each of these transmissions by about 2 minutes of interval signal or jingle.
Dennis Thompson. And Stocks and Funds' future plans include a television service and the hiring of medium-wave airtime in the new year to strengthen their signal to the Middle East.
Ladies and gentlemen, remember that Deanna and Jonathan use special receiving equipment to compile this program. Don't try this at home without parental supervision.
Yes, we're only joking. The World Radio TV Handbook's just launched its 97th edition, earlier than usual, and at the same time they've announced the results of the 9th annual award scheme. This year things changed a bit. They're now reviewing both receivers and the new media. The 96-97 awards have been given in four categories, and here are the results.
The best shortwave portable is the Sanjin ATS-909. Sanjin is one of the largest shortwave portable receiver manufacturers in the world. They make sets under their own brand and for a number of other manufacturers, for instance Siemens and Philips. They have concentrated on making shortwave affordable and have a major market share in Asia and Europe in particular. Their latest set, the ATS-909, shows that the company is ready for the future. The World Radio TV Handbook says they understand that ease of tuning and good performance for a reasonable price requires innovation.
The second award for the best tabletop receiver goes to the AOR AR7030. Now that availability's improved, this new set from AOR has settled down at the top end of tabletop communications receivers. Especially in Europe, the price performance offered by this new set is outstanding. The radio set had developed further in 97 with software control, and the WRTH was impressed by AOR's after-sales service.
New this year are two awards connected with the new media. In the opinion of the judges, the most useful website in the volunteer category went to Pete Costello's Shortwave Catalogue. This website can be found at http://itre.uncecs.edu/radio, and it's regularly updated. Pete clearly spends hours surfing the internet looking for interesting radio-related sites and is now helped by regular feedback. If there's one site that you must put in your bookmarks, it's this one. It's a labour of love.
And the most useful website in the professional category went to the South African Broadcasting Corporation at www.sabc.co.za. A fine example of how to present easily accessible and up-to-date information on the web. The pages are attractively designed without using large graphic files, so access is acceptably fast, even with a 14.4K modem. SABC's decision to include the full text of its staff newsletter provides a unique insight into the inner workings of a public service broadcaster undergoing major restructuring.
We love updates on this programme. It's one thing to be present at the start of a project and report about a new idea. Television is full of these sorts of programmes. But there's hardly any follow-up as to what happened after a great idea was launched onto the market.
In September 95, inventor Trevor Bayliss was one of the guests at the Towards 2000 conference in Amsterdam. He was behind the development of a clockwork-driven radio. Despite several problems launching the idea, he eventually found backers and they set up a factory to turn the idea into reality. The Beigen Free Play Radio is now in the shops in many parts of Europe and North America. Media Network listener Harold Sellers notes it recently appeared in Toronto, being sold at a trendy shop downtown at a price of $150 Canadian. In the Netherlands, it's priced at 175 guilders, found in most shops that sell products from developing countries.
It was late November 1995 when the first batch of Bayliss clockwork radios came off the production line at a factory just outside Cape Town in South Africa. Production was initially set at 20,000 units a month, But was that target met? Well, I've just returned from a few days in Cape Town to attend a communications conference, and part of the agenda turned out to be a 30-minute bus ride to an industrial estate outside the city called Montague Gardens, where Beijing has its factory. The plant turned out to be a fairly big hall, and walking inside, it looks pretty new and efficient. The walls and assembly line are painted in bright colors. Toby Sutcliffe is the commercial manager worldwide for the Beijing Power Company. Just over a year after production started, I asked him how well the project was going.
Up until the middle of October, we'd produced and sold 114,000 radios worldwide, and with the intention, obviously, is to grow the markets in each specific country as we go along and not just drop the radio into those particular countries and leave them and let them try and move on their own. Our major successes worldwide have been in Europe. In Holland, in fact, we have a gentleman called Mr. Frank Govers operating out of Tilburg in the Netherlands, and he's been pretty successful in the marketing of our radio. We're doing very, very well in the United States, which is our top performer at the moment, which was totally against the grain as far as our research and development was concerned, where we developed the radio for aid organizations in the African market, the third world, and to find that it's going exceptionally well in the first world has been an eye-opener for us.
Isn't that a bit sad then? I mean, you have a factory here in South Africa, and the radios you sell go to Europe and the United States.
Well, to be honest with you, this is a commercial operation. We don't really mind where they're sold worldwide. Our aim and objective is to make radios and to sell them worldwide.
A Dutch band in Holland was so impressed with the concept of the clockwork radio, they recorded a song for possible help in promotion. Yet advertising in South Africa is pointless because the radio is not in the shops.
A major problem is in South Africa and throughout most of Africa is the tax or the duties that is imposed on the particular radio, or on all radios, in fact, throughout Africa. We at the moment have made a deputation to our government in South Africa to request that the duty be re-looked. We're not saying being abolished altogether, because we would then have an unfair advantage over our competitors, but to be re-looked at with the hope of getting it more affordable to the average working person. And the same thing applies throughout Africa. We're looking at a totally different marketing approach, where we're looking at doing what we call a semi-knockdown componentry operation, which means that we supply the radio to those countries in pieces. And all they do is they put the pieces together, which then gets us around paying all the duties, which sometimes are between 60 and 80% in Africa.
But when it comes to expansion, do you think of moving to other parts of the world, or will you expand in Africa?
The objective is to create employment within South Africa, and we want to stay with that as long as possible.
The prototype radios were grey. The production models are black. But I saw several dozens of fluorescent green, yellow and blue sets and the whole warehouse full of red ones. Beijing is also working on a new design.
The coloured radios are not available on the market just yet. I've just returned from an extended trip where we did the various coloured radios, took photographs of them and took them to our respective distributors that I met with the aim of launching them in March or so next year. We haven't decided yet what particular colours we're going to do. We've given them a full range and they are to report back to us which ones they believe. But with regards to the new radio, obviously we're looking at improving the design, improving the size, bring out a radio that's at least half the size of the existing one, which obviously then has a direct bearing on the cost, and then make it more marketable, which we believe we can do. And also extending the playtime, the length of playtime that you're getting out the radio, which at the moment is between 30 and 35 minutes. We would like to, if possible, to try and double the playtime using the existing spring we're using now.
And the radios you've sold so far, did you mostly sell them via shops, or did you sell them via NGOs and non-profit organizations?
I think that the NGO market has been about 30% of our sales of the 114,000 so far, but the rest have been sort of commercially done, what they term off-the-page advertising in catalogues, advertisements placed in various camping, outdoor, caravanning-type magazines, and then direct dial-in numbers with the publicity we've managed to receive from television shows.
Doesn't anybody complain about the use of plastic for the radio? I mean, it's all very environmentally friendly. You don't have to use batteries. But it's a bulky radio made of plastic.
The plastic's not an issue because the plastic we're using is totally environmentally friendly, so people are not really worried about that. We've spoken to Greenpeace. They're very, very happy to look at promoting the radio for us next year. They were busy with a plastics campaign when we spoke to them, anti-plastics campaign, but they just said that the product itself has so many good features for them from an environmental point of view that they're looking at doing a promotion with us worldwide early next year.
Walking around here in the factory, I see that there are quite a lot of Coca-Cola Bajan radios. What's the story behind that?
We were approached by Coca-Cola North Africa to make some radios for them with the intention of a joint promotion whereby people buying Coca-Colas and the liners, which is the inside of the bottle top, once you've collected three different liners, you would then qualify for a free play radio. And that was really where the colored thing started. I mean, they asked for a red radio with their logo on, and as such, we did it, and we did 5,600 radios to start with. And it's going so well for them. They've asked us, please, to do some more in a hurry for them. The order was given to us a day or so ago, and we're dispatching early next week. That's giving us about 4 or 5 days turnaround time.
And where does Coca-Cola market them?
At the moment, in Uganda, Tanzania, and Kenya are the three countries that we're looking at doing the whole project with them, with the intention that if this is a success, to expand into more countries within the North African division of Coca-Cola. The core product we have here is not a radio. The core product we have is a generator. It's a wind-up generator. Obviously, we have an incredible amount of research and development to do to make the generator portion sufficiently powerful to drive, well, what needs electricity today, what needs batteries. And that's really where we're aiming at. I don't think we're going to be silly about it. We're not going to try and develop and design 40 different products at a time. We're going to systematically go through what we believe are the core products needed to support the development of education worldwide is the major thing we're looking at.
Another idea is to strengthen the use for educational programming throughout Africa, especially with family planning and AIDS awareness schemes.
That through the World Bank, who make loans to those particular governments, would buy a number of radios. They would then put together educational programs which would be transmitted over certain stations within their territory to educate people from schooling right through to AIDS awareness. And that's what we're working at the moment, trying to put projects together throughout Africa.
110 people, of which 30% are disabled, produce 25,000 radios a month. But I had to ask, who needs such radio in North America?
And it's not for people who can't afford batteries. The market in the United States is really... there's a market there called the Mr. Gadget market, and there's over 12 million people in the Mr. Gadget. And have you got one of these, that particular thing? And obviously we're looking at the various niche markets, being the caravanners, the outdoors, the survivalists, the radio enthusiasts, people along those lines, and that's where the radios are being sold at the moment.
Media Network is crafted together weekly at this time. Roadshow management and hotel logistics were handled by Esther van der Plaum. Fashion advice from Jan Hoek. Copyright 1996, all rights reserved.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.